The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
The Nicole Sandler Show. Questioning authority daily. And that could be the very reason why YouTube is upset. Hey, YouTube. The music bed you hear beneath my voice is from a broadcast sound library that I paid for and have the receipts. So I've got your copyright violation right here. And now, here's Nicole.
All right, here we go. Oh, there's an issue. Hold on. I changed some settings. Bear with me for 1 second, everybody. I changed, YouTubers, I changed some settings in this new system that I have. And for some reason, it's not giving me audio. So this should have fixed it. Hi, YouTube. Now we have audio. Yeah, I don't know what happened. I'm playing with my new setup here. I've got this brand new mixing board, which for those of you audio files out there, it is a Zoom LiveTrack L8, if that means anything to you. I'm learning it. I'm getting all the ins and outs and working out some of the bugs, trying to figure out how to bring three different computers into the mix because you should have sound. Still no sound? Okay, now you have sound. Good. There's lots of different features this thing has, and it's just trial and error. I'm going through it and trying to get rid of noise coming in from one computer, going out to another, and so it's a process. So I changed one of the audio inputs, and I just screwed everything up. So hopefully now it's all working. We shall see. May have a few more glitches before it's all ironed out, but hopefully you're noticing an improvement. I think the sound should be better. I hope. Anyway, welcome to a Wednesday. What a week, right? What a week this has been. Yesterday was just a crazy day, and so I've got some stuff to share with you from both the Supreme Court hearing yesterday dealing with whether or not Donald Trump, as president, I still can't put that together. Is above the law because that's how he's acting, right? And also the Senate Help Committee hearing on the COVID crisis. So I've got sound from both. I was able to digest all of it a little bit. But the other thing is, we are in pretty much uncharted economic territory, for this generation. Now, maybe some of our parents perhaps lived in the Great Depression, but for the majority of Americans alive now, we were not around during the Great Depression. And seeing the job numbers, let me put up the for YouTube, the show card for today, which is the new bikini chart, basically showing the historic job losses for April. And there's this little dip that shows up at around 2008 that underneath it says Great Recession. Now, on the older bikini charts, that little dip was humongous, showing that, when Barack Obama came into office, we were hemorrhaging something like 900,000 jobs a month. That was a big deal. But it's nothing compared to 20 million jobs. We are truly in uncharted territory. So after the labor report came out on Friday, I thought, who best to talk to about this? Because this is a depression. We are in depression era numbers. And again, the one economist who I know and love is Stephanie Kelton. And not only is she an amazing economist, she's got to be an incredible professor. Because every time we talk, I understand a little bit more about modern monetary theory. And Stephanie Kelton has a new book coming out. It's less than a month away. It's been coming for a while now, but it'll be out on June 9th. And so I reached out to her. I guest hosted the broadcast for Brad Friedman on Monday. So I spoke to Stephanie on Monday morning always figuring I would share that with you. So here we go. So today, we'll go through the news and some of the audio that I have from the two different hearings yesterday, and then we'll go back and listen to the interview that I did with Stephanie Kelton, because you know, who knows what's going to happen with the economy, and she actually she eased my fears a little bit. Not much, but a little bit. But she's on the right track. I mean, there's, I wonder, do I have it in here? In today's What's News, let me see if I, and actually this didn't make What's News. This came upon later. But the Fed chairman, Jay Powell, today said that Congress needs to continue to spend money to keep the country from calamity. Here's the quote. While the economic response has been both timely and appropriately large, it may not be the final chapter, given that the path ahead is both highly uncertain and subject to significant downside risks. He said this is the worst economic downturn since World War II, you think? Then he said additional fiscal support could be costly, but worth it if it helps avoid long-term economic damage and leaves us with a stronger recovery. This trade-off is one for our elected representatives who wield powers of taxation and spending. And for, you know, not to overreach here when I talk about MMT, modern monetary theory, yes, Judy Truitt in the YouTube chat room, she's asking, doesn't MMT mean we can just print as much money as we want? Pretty much. Yes. And that's kind of what it says. So Stephanie Kelton has this new book coming out June 9th called The Deficit Myth. So we'll talk a little bit about that, but also about the economic situation we find ourselves in today. But before we get to any of that, you know, I like to start the show with something funny, because again, today is going to get kind of serious. So we will begin with a new one. Boy, the Founder Singh, these people are prolific. I don't know a whole lot about them, except they burst onto the song parody scene a couple of months ago with a great parody of Don McLean's American Pie. And it was the founding fathers in those deep fake videos singing. And they've since, they put out one or two videos a week, it seems. And here's their newest one. Oh, it's a song you'll be familiar with. Take it away, Founder Singh. Here we go.
Stuck inside this nightmare. Feels like it's forever. Swimming in this pond scum once again with you, William, you, William, you. Yeah, we're kicking you out of here, 'cause you're pissing it all away. You deface our democracy, and you hit a new low each day. So we're kicking you out of here. Yeah, we're kicking you out of here.
If you're watching on YouTube, you can sing along.
Well, our heads exploded with a mighty crash when you said let Flynn go free. He's a proven liar, twice he admitted that, and soon you're gonna be bar on the run, bar on the run, and the jail. Justice finally comes.
Yes, Founders Sing is the name that they go by. That's what their YouTube channel is under, Founders Sing, and they are just prolific and quite genius, actually. The animation on it is beautiful because they use that deep fake technology to make, well, in this case, Paul McCartney sing. And if you're not, if you're familiar with a Band on the Run album cover, well, all the picture is all the characters from Bill Barr to Trump to Michael Cohen to Jared Kushner and everyone else. And they're all bopping along and singing along. It's pretty fabulous. As usual, I will post that video on the blog today at NicoleSandler.com/5-13-20, because today is May 13th. 2020. And there we go. All right. The interview with Stephanie Kelton, like I said, we taped it on Monday, and it's fairly lengthy. So let's get to some of the news right now, shall we? And again, excuse my jumping around. If you're watching, I'm using like three different computers to do all this. And hopefully it'll all work. We'll see. Anyway. All right. Let's see if this works. So far, so good. Oh, boy. All right. And yes, we'll do it live.
We'll do it live. Fuck it.
Okay.
We'll do it live.
Thank you, Bill.
I'll write it and we'll do it live.
Okay, Bill. Thank you, Bill.
Fucking thing.
Okay,
sucks.
Bill. Enough, Bill. We're on a time schedule here. So it was a split screen Tuesday in America yesterday as the Senate Health Committee heard testimony from some of our nation's most important medical experts on the coronavirus crisis. And the Supreme Court heard arguments via teleconference about subpoenas for Donald Trump's tax returns and financial records. So let's start in the Senate, all right, where Dr. Anthony Fauci yesterday warned of unnecessary suffering and death if governors reopen state economies before implementing adequate safeguards against a renewed surge in coronavirus infections.
My concern that if some areas, cities, states, or what have you, jump over those various checkpoints and prematurely open up without having the capability of being able to respond effectively and efficiently, my concern is that we will start to see little spikes that might turn into outbreaks. There is a real risk that you will trigger an outbreak that you may not be able to control, which in fact, paradoxically, will set you back, not only leading to some suffering and death that could be avoided, but could even set you back on the road to trying to get economic recovery.
You think? Now, that is Dr. Anthony Fauci testifying by video before the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee yesterday. Fauci and two other witnesses, Dr. Robert Redfield, the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and Stephen Hahn, the head of the Food and Drug Administration, both testified, or all three of them testified, under self-quarantine after possible exposure to the virus. One particularly heated exchange came between Dr. Fauci and Rand Paul, senator from Kentucky, who battled COVID last month. Here's an edited back and forth.
I think we ought to have a little bit of humility in our belief that we know what's best for the economy. And as much as I respect you, Dr. Fauci, I don't think you're the end all. I don't think you're the one person that gets to make a decision. If we keep kids out of school for another year, what's going to happen is the poor and underprivileged kids who don't have a parent that's able to teach them at home are not going to learn for a full year.
You use the word we should be humble about what we don't know. And I think that falls under the fact that we don't know everything about this virus. And we really better be very careful, particularly when it comes to children, because the more and more we learn, we're seeing things about what this virus can do that we didn't see from the studies in China or in Europe. We better be careful if we are not cavalier in thinking that children are completely immune to the deleterious effects. I am very careful and hopefully humble in knowing that I don't know everything about this disease.
Yeah, it was a bit of a like, fuck you. Well, fuck you, too. Between Rand Paul and Fauci. And Fauci, I think, came out on top. Now, the hearing was held as the U.S. death toll surpassed 82,000. It's already up over 83,000, with a total of around 1.4 million infections in the U.S. alone. And over on Fox so-called News, the hosts, who are all working from home and have been told they're going to stay at home probably until September, they ramped up a smear campaign against Fauci following his testimony yesterday. Here's just a little sample of some of those Fox things doing their dirty work.
Is this the guy you want to chart the future of the country? Maybe not. This is a very serious matter, the decisions we're making right now. Tony Fauci has not been elected to anything.
Some people
seem to think he should be dictator for the duration of this crisis.
Better him than Trump.
That's insanity.
Fauci, to be very blunt, is the face of this failed administrative state.
I totally agree.
We've got to question the entire premise of this.
The chief buffoon.
Dr. Anthony Fauci also seems to favor what the Democrats want, and that is massive restrictions with no end in sight.
All due respect to Dr. Fauci's expertise, no one elected him to anything.
You know what I say to those people?
Asshole.
Right. Yeah, he needs an S on the end of it, Keith. Anyway, that's going on. Unbelievable. Now, at the same time as the Senate hearing was happening, the Supreme Court began hearing three landmark cases involving Trump's effort to fight subpoenas from the House of Representatives and from a New York prosecutor, both asking for Trump's income tax returns and other financial records. The cases involve demands for access to records from Trump's accounting firm, Mazars USA, and two banks, Capital One and Deutsche Bank. Trump's lawyers were arguing that prosecutors have no constitutional right to demand his records while he's in office and that lawmakers have no legitimate right to the material or no legitimate need for the material. Really? In the second hearing of the day, there were two. The first one was over the House subpoenas. The second one was regarding the New York State subpoenas. And Trump's personal lawyer, Jay Sekulow, argued before the court in that second trial, and it was as bad as you would expect. Jay Sekulow repeatedly suggested that Donald Trump had special immunity because he's the president, just as Sonia Sotomayor disagreed.
Don't we usually presume that state courts and state prosecutors act as they should and in good faith?
Even if you were to assume that...
If you let me finish. And doesn't the president always have the opportunity to show that a particular subpoena, in fact, was issued in bad faith? President was given that opportunity here.
Yeah.
And a affidavit, I understand, was filed under seal, setting forth the reasonable grounds for the investigation. I'm not sure why he's entitled to more immunity for private acts than he should be for public acts.
Well, he's the president of the United States.
Are you kidding me?
He's a branch of the federal government.
Did you hear what he just said?
We only give
judicial officers and
congressional officers immunity for acts within their official capacity.
Jay Sekulow said to Justice Sotomayor, who said, I don't understand why he should get special treatment here. And Jay Sekulow said, because he's the president of the United States. Yeah, that's how it went. Look, as bad as the government's lawyer was in the first hearing, his name was Latter, he was terrible. That's how bad Sekulow was in the second. So the justices' questions suggested a minor split between the court's conservatives, who were wary of presidential, quote, harassment, and the liberals, who said presidents shouldn't be above the law. And Justice Elena Kagan felt compelled to tell Trump's lawyer, Jay Sekulow, exactly that.
So, Mr. Sekulow, you've said that a number of times and made the point, which we have made, that presidents can't be treated just like an ordinary citizen, but it's also true, and indeed a fundamental precept of our constitutional order, that a president isn't above the law.
Nope.
From our first days, Chief Justice Marshall told Thomas Jefferson that he could be subpoenaed, he could be examined as a witness, he could be required to produce papers. And so I guess going back to Justice Breyer's question, why isn't the way to deal with these two things, that the president is special, but that the president is like an ordinary citizen in that he's subject to law, is to say the president can make these usual objections that a subpoena recipient can make about harassment or about burden, And the court, in reviewing those, of course, should take seriously the president's objections and treat those with a certain kind of sensitivity and respect due to somebody who is a branch of government. Why isn't that the right way to do it?
For two reasons. First, and I think the case here is the perfect example. Here, the district attorney copied verbatim the House Oversight Committee and Ways and Means Committee subpoena.
So we were
just discussing in the previous case the nature of that burden.
What?
For counsel, the president hiring counsel, for each time he could be subpoenaed as a witness, or in this particular case as a target, would raise a serious impact on the president's Article 2 function.
So we think
a categorical approach, and it's very specific here, state process as to the president, targeting the president's documents in a criminal proceeding should be prohibited.
Okay, it should be prohibitive. The other part of Jay Sekulow's argument, I went looking for it, but honestly, I couldn't deal with listening to him. But he kept repeating over and over again, this is a distraction. It will distract the president from his presidential duties. That was the single funniest line that I heard all day. And I actually watched some, you know, comedy stuff on television last night. The fact that Jay Sekulow is using as a defense the fact that all of this, these lawsuits and these subpoenas and everything would distract Donald Trump from his duties as president is just patently absurd. The man who spent Sunday tweeting and retweeting 127 some odd times, that guy, they're worried about him being distracted. Come on. Come on, man. Come on. All right. Very quickly, in other news, this is big. You know, so last week we were talking about, and the song, the Barr on the Run song was about the Attorney General, William Barr, saying, well, we're going to drop those charges against Michael Flynn for lying to the FBI, even though he confessed to the crime. What we were told was that Barr can say whatever he wants, but it's actually up to the judge as to whether or not they will drop those charges. Well, the judge spoke yesterday, and what did Emmett Sullivan do? He said, uh-uh. He held up the Justice Department's motion to drop the charges against Michael Flynn. Sullivan said he expected independent groups and legal experts to challenge the Trump administration's determination that Flynn should never have been charged with lying to the FBI. Flynn, as I just said, did plead guilty 2.5 years ago to lying to federal agents about his contacts with the Russian ambassador. He later tried to get out of his plea deal, and the Justice Department last week, under Bill Barr, took the highly irregular step of reversing its efforts to uphold the plea. Critics have called that move politically motivated, and now the judge in the case, Emmett Sullivan, says, not so fast, buddy. Let's let this play itself out. He expects independent groups and legal experts to challenge this determination. He is going to let those challenges come forth. Bring them on. Oh, yeah. So that's a bit of what's going on in the news right now. There's more on What's News. And if you go to NicoleSandler.com and you click on the What's News tab, there's usually an extended What's News episode. I podcast it out every day. If you subscribe to the regular podcast, you get What's News each morning. And what I do for the Progressive Voices Network is a 6-minute newscast, but there's usually a lot more than 6 minutes worth of news. So I do the extended What's News that's available, like I said, as a podcast every day. So go get it. And they're all posted at NicoleSandler.com as well. Okay, now here's this for a segue. I mentioned at the beginning that, I'm looking at these, the job losses, the job numbers for on Friday when they were released. And again, let me show you that graph. Once again, if you're on YouTube, you see the line going across the top. These are the historic job loss figures reported for April. First, you see like in the 1940s, there was a dip. There was something in the 70s, barely perceptible. Then you get to 2008, you see another dip where the Great Recession happened. And then you see the line go straight down off the cliff. And so when I called Stephanie Kelton, I wanted to ask her, are we officially in a depression yet? So with no further ado, my conversation with the amazing Stephanie Kelton. This happened Monday, just in case you were wondering. Here we go. I'm so happy to be able to welcome Stephanie Kelton back to the show. Stephanie is an economist and an educator. She's currently a professor at Stony Brook University, was formerly a professor at University of Missouri, Kansas City. She's served as an advisor to Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign. And her new book is coming out soon, I think next month. It's called The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy. Stephanie Kelton, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
When is the book officially out?
June 9th.
June 9th. So we're getting there, getting close.
Yep. Seems like it's taken forever, but we're almost there.
Okay. And the timing is perfect, because I would think right now a lot of people are even more curious about modern monetary theory than before. Before we get into that, though, I got to ask you, I reached out to you because Friday we watched the new job numbers come in for April. The U.S. economy lost 20.5 million jobs last month. The unemployment rate went from 4.4% to 14.7%, at the highest since 1939 when they started keeping track of these things. Are we officially in a depression?
Well, I mean, there's not really a universally agreed upon definition, but I think by most reasonable accounts, this has risen to historic standards that look very much like depression level unemployment numbers. So eventually, I'm sure we will reach the point where people begin to describe the situation that we're in terms of the economy as a depression.
It's frightening. I mean, when you saw those numbers, and we were prepared for them. I mean, in fact, they were bracing us for an even higher. They said the unemployment rate could be up as high as 16%. It was only 14.7. But on Face the Nation this weekend, Kevin Hassett, who's a White House economic advisor, said he thinks the unemployment rate will rise to north of 20% next month, because this only measured like halfway through April, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the estimates vary, of course, but there are people out there who have warned that we could see unemployment, official unemployment figures, rise above 30%. I think former Fed chairperson Janet Yellen has suggested that, you know, that's a reasonable forecast to be thinking about right now. So, in other words, levels of unemployment that exceed what we experienced in the Great Depression, which was about 25% or one in four people out of the unemployed.
Right. And before this happened, before we got hit with the coronavirus pandemic, the employment picture was already kind of shaky because of technology and artificial intelligence and consolidation. I mean, I've worked my entire career in the broadcasting industry. We've seen massive job losses over the last decade or so due to technology, due to things called voice tracking and the consolidation of big broadcasting companies. So we were already hurting. And then for this to happen and all these massive job losses, these are scary times. When you look at these numbers as an economist, Stephanie, does it freak you out?
Oh, well, no question. I mean, the idea that 20 plus million people lost jobs in a single month is jarring for any economist. There's absolutely no question that this is, you know, on an order of magnitude beyond what we think about, you know, ways to respond in terms of economic policy, the macroeconomic policy response. You know, we all have these textbooks. We teach our students if something happens in the economy to create a downturn, a slowdown in the, in the economy, there are things that policymakers can do using fiscal and monetary policy. But these are sort of tinkering at the margins. You know, there's nothing that you can turn to the page in the textbook that tells you how to handle 20 million people losing their jobs in a single month. So yes, and you know, your point about where we were prior to this, of course, you know, Donald Trump would tell you that we had the greatest economy in the history of the universe,
right,
that he was the greatest jobs president God ever created. The official unemployment rate was down around 3.5%. But, you know, the thing is that most of the new jobs that were created since the last crisis, remember the 2008 financial crisis and the Great Recession, took us 76 months to claw fully our way back to where we erased all of the job losses and started creating additional net new jobs. So that was a very long and slow economic recovery. But as you point out, the jobs that were created were overwhelmingly low hour and low wage jobs. So we didn't bring back the higher paying, better jobs that were lost in the last recession. We brought back jobs, but we replaced them with lower paying, lower wage, lower hours jobs. So you're right to say it wasn't, you know, the be-all and end-all labor market that President Trump would have had us believe.
Right. And but he keeps repeating those numbers and those claims. In fact, he went on last week to say, I built the best economy in the history of the world. Just to, you know, drive home, he built nothing, right? This was building on the Obama administration's turning around of the disastrous economy left by the Bush administration. When Obama took office, we were losing, what, 900,000 jobs a month or something ridiculous like that? And we had been until last month on a steady 11-year climb with the economy getting better and better, right? So Trump built on the Obama administration's turnaround of the economy. Am I overstating that?
Well, no, not entirely. But again, those jobs that we did bring back in most instances were not as good as the jobs that had been lost. So I don't want to give 5 stars to, you know, the last 10 years or so either. But you're absolutely right to say that, you know, Donald Trump doesn't get to take credit for a long-term trajectory of steady but fairly low economic growth and steady improvement in the labor market.
Right. So he'll say whatever he's going to say. We've learned that every time he opens his mouth, lies come out and we can't trust what he says. Again, the Obama administration didn't, again, we didn't see jobs come back with, you know, higher salaries. We saw some numbers come back. But, you know, but again, I'm pointing out Trump saying, I built the best economy in the history of the world. And that simply is just not true.
No, he didn't totally destroy it. You know, I mean, what did he do? What is the major legislative accomplishment from this administration over the last 3 years? What is it?
Big tax cut for billionaires.
Right. It's the tax cuts that were pushed through in December of 2017. That is the major legislative accomplishment. You said it exactly correctly, that we did big tax breaks for corporations on the corporate income tax side. And when it came to the personal income tax, what you and I pay, the benefits went disproportionately to the people who least needed the help. 83% of the benefits went to people in the top 1% of the income distribution. So, you know, he did that. We got some deregulation, and then he did the tariffs.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to the extent that he counterbalanced some of the harmful impacts that his tariffs caused with a little bit of a break for people in the bottom 99%, you know, where 17% of the benefits went to people in the bottom 99%, he didn't totally wreck everything, but he absolutely did not and could not possibly credibly take credit for a booming, thriving U.S. economy under
right
administration.
Now one thing, Stephanie, that's happened since Trump took office is the stock market. And some pundits, some people in the administration, Trump included, will point to the stock market to say, look how great the stock market's doing. That just proves that our economy is doing so well. Well, there are most of Americans, myself included, don't have any money invested in the stock market. And just because the stock market's doing well doesn't mean the economy is doing well for us. What kind of an indicator is the stock market on the overall health of the economy?
Well, you know, sometimes there is a correlation that makes some sense. Mm-hmm. You see a healthy, growing economy. You see workers doing better, and you can see the stock market improving alongside that sort of thing. Okay, it happened in the last 4 years or so of the Clinton administration. But for the most part, there's a large disconnect between these two things, right? Where what is perceived as good for the stock market can actually be quite bad for the working people of this country. So in other words, you saw the job numbers, the unemployment rate the other day. You said 20.5 million people lost jobs. And what did the market do that day?
It went up.
So look, I think that a lot of what we are seeing with respect to the stock market today is that investors feel very confident that the Federal Reserve is going to pull out all the stops, do whatever it takes to protect big corporations, to protect investors, to protect the financial system. And that is building confidence in terms of investors who aren't fleeing the stock market in terror because they feel like the Fed has their back. And they do.
Right. And in fact, you know, for those of us who are wondering why the stock market is still relatively doing well, it's down, we're recording this 10 o'clock Monday morning, down 221 now. It's been down around 200 points since it opened about a half hour ago. But it's, I mean, over 24,000. And for those of us wondering how, the Fed has been injecting record amounts of money to keep it going, haven't they?
Well, yes, and you also, I think, have to ask, what is the alternative? Mm-hmm. I mean, we just stepped back. If the Fed just stepped back and, you know, didn't have these lending facilities and didn't stand ready to provide liquidity and support businesses in this moment, then we would just start seeing a cascading wave of failures across, you know, the corporate sector, business community, and we'd have an even worse unemployment picture. So we're in a situation where to a very large and real extent, protecting some of these firms and municipalities and backstopping others indirectly does help to support jobs. It's just that the Fed is, you know, one institution. The Fed can lend, it can't spend. And what we really need is much, much more support coming from the fiscal side, coming from Congress, because as I said, the Fed can lend, it can't spend. And what we need is not to layer more debt, right? More lending means more debt. We need Congress to step up and protect jobs and shore up the economy using fiscal policy.
Right. And now we learn that the House is working on the next round of stimulus. They have like a $1.2 trillion package that they want to introduce. And when I say the House, I mean the Democrats leading the House. Republicans, though, are starting to do their old, oh no, too expensive, we can't spend the money. Here we are in the U.S. We all, most of us, have gotten our $1,200, whatever they want to call it, stimulus check. And those who haven't will get it shortly. But I've been talking to people all over the world. I've been doing this segment called Quarantine Calling, where I check in with people in different countries. And every other country I've spoken to, people are getting real serious, excuse me, financial help from the government, whether it's Canada or the UK or Denmark or Norway. They're getting, in some places, a portion, 80, 90% of their salary every month. Canada people are getting $2,000 a month. We got a paltry one-time payment of $1,200. That's not helping the average person who's hurting right now, is it?
Well, it's certainly not helping enough for a lot of people. You know, you're right. There are countries that committed early on to recurring payments rather than this one-off, a one-time $1,200 check. I call it stimulus. I don't call it stimulus because I think the idea is basically to keep people, to keep us staying in place, just to try to contain it and hold it all together. You know, what are people mostly doing with that money? Well, if you didn't need it, because a lot of people will say, look, I didn't actually need it. I still have my job. My income is face no disruption in my income. I can pay my rent and I'm, you know, so maybe these people will hold on to it, save it for a little while. A lot of people are using it to buy groceries and pay some recurring expenses, pay the utility bill, make a rent payment. But you can't stretch $1,200 very far in this economy, you know, you can buy a few groceries and maybe cover a month of rent, and then it runs out. Right. So the real thing that Congress did, which was very good, was the expansion of unemployment insurance and including non-traditional workers, allowing gig workers and others to apply for and get unemployment compensation. And then that extra $600 a week that the federal government is kicking in, it has actually been very, very important, and it has protected incomes. And in some cases, actually in many cases, the frontline low-income workers who were the earliest to lose jobs have seen their incomes protected in total, right? And in many cases, they're actually bringing in a little bit more now than they were making in their very low-wage jobs that they were working when they were employed. So, but the problem is, of course, that's going to run out.
Right, right. And now let's bring modern monetary theory into this, right? How would an administration who operated under a monetary policy such as modern monetary theory differ from what this administration is doing?
Well, I think that one of the main things is that you don't place arbitrary caps on your fiscal response because, you know, look at the Small Business Administration, the so-called Paycheck Protection Program, mm-hmm. right? That was in the CARES Act. That was that third piece of legislation that Congress passed, the $2.2 trillion. So that's the biggest one we've seen so far. And that was designed to keep workers attached to their employers, to keep them on payroll. And Congress said, okay, we'll stick a certain number on this. We'll call it, I think it was $348 billion or so.
Okay.
And that's the program. Well, that quickly ran out, right? So in one of the answers to your question is these caps are a problem. And the reason that we put caps on things is to contain the amount of spending that we're willing to do. And if you were working from an MMT perspective, you would say, what is the problem we're trying to solve? Put the money piece aside, because that's the easy part. We can mm-hmm. always appropriate funding in whatever size we deem necessary to handle the problem we're trying to solve. So MMT would ask us to figure out what the problem is and design the policy to address the problem. If it's keeping people attached to their employers on payroll so they don't become unemployed, then you don't set up all of these arbitrary hoops. You run it through banks who were ill-prepared. We just didn't execute well. And so I think, you know, recognizing that you have to stand ready to provide whatever funding is necessary to solve the problems that you're trying to solve, without placing arbitrary restrictions on the size of the amount of money that can be borrowed, too many restrictions on how that money had to be used. A lot of employers didn't think that they could keep workers on payroll. A lot of employers said, wait, you're requiring me to spend 75% of the money on payroll, but actually my payroll costs are low. It's my rent and my utilities that are high because I'm in a high rent district or something like that. So that's one of the problems.
And if you were all of a sudden, you know, Steven Mnuchin called you in and said, all right, Stephanie Kelton, we need a different mindset here. We need a different, way of looking at things. What would your advice be? How would you get us through this mess?
Well, look, I think that it's almost impossible to go too big. There are going to be inefficiencies. There are going to be people who get money who, in retrospect, you think, well, we shouldn't have made that loan or we shouldn't have provided that form of assistance. But, you know, in some ways, Nicole, it's almost like you wish you could just have everybody, take an oath and say, under penalty of perjury and fraud and prosecution and so forth, I am going to log into this website. I'm going to answer this series of questions. There are countries that have rolled out something like this, where, you know, you answer six or seven questions and you say, are you facing hardship? Yes or no? Yeah, mm-hmm. You click the button. What are your recurring expenses? You click the button. How much income, cash flow do you currently have? You click the button. What is your estimated shortfall in terms of necessary recurring expenses? You say, my current recurring shortfall is $1,700 a month, $2,300 a month, $3,500, whatever it is, and you click the next button, And that's the disbursement that comes.
Wow.
Okay? 3 days from now, you've got that money in your paycheck. And you say, I'm protecting my workers. I'm keeping them on payroll. I'm paying my utilities. None of this, you know, I was also thinking about buying a car. So I want to factor that in. No. This is for, you know, necessary recurring expenses to allow companies, businesses, small businesses in particular, to avoid shuttering. Right, to avoid going under, mm-hmm. to keep their workers protected, to keep families protected so that they don't get evicted from their apartments, so that they don't end up losing their home, so that their credit is not permanently impaired by this. I mean, that's the sort of big time intervention that could hold the whole thing together. Because you know what? We have the real economy and then we have the financial side of everything. We ought to be able to pause the real economy without having everything completely fall apart. And the reason that things start to completely fall apart is because of the financial piece. It's that chain of interconnected payment commitments, debt, right? You got to pay your rent. You got to pay your utilities. You have a car payment. You have this. You miss one of those. And then there's someone on the other side, a lender who doesn't receive a payment they were counting on, who then can't turn around and meet their payments. So you got to figure out where you need to press on the financial chain to alleviate the strain that allows everything to kind of stay together until we're through this thing.
It is frightening. And look, in your lifetime, this is what you do. You're an economist. You deal with this on a daily basis. Have you ever thought we'd get to a point where we're seeing numbers like this and an outlook like this?
Well, no, I mean, not to this scale. But look, one of the things that my colleagues and I, the MMT academic economists who have been, you know, thinking a lot about ways to have government policy respond to build a more resilient economy for more than 20 years, we've been urging lawmakers to think about adopting a jobs program. Mm-hmm. We call it a federal job guarantee or public service employment. You could say we want to build a care force. I mean, I don't care really how you describe it, but the idea is that you need a public option in the labor market. We needed to have something that was in place and capable of immediately absorbing people as they became unemployed. Well, as their employers let them go or furloughed them, laid them off, they could immediately transition into another form of employment. Instead of becoming unemployed, the government hires them. They remain employed. They have benefits. They're protected. Their incomes are protected through this process. And it's a program that should be in place in good times and in bad. And if all of a sudden 20 million people are without work, that program is there. And you immediately hire those 20 million people into the program. You replace much or in some cases all of the lost income, depending on what they were making before. They keep their health care because the benefits are part of the package and so forth. So, you know, we weren't thinking, wow, this is a program that's going to be important when we lose 20 million jobs in a month. But we were thinking that capitalist economies go through a business cycle. And there are never enough jobs, not even in the best of times, for everyone who wants employment but can't find it anywhere else in the economy. There ought to be an option even in the best of times. But in the worst of times, when the bottom is falling out and millions of people are losing jobs, there should be a program that can respond automatically to absorb these people, provide incomes, maintain some benefits. And so that's something we've been working on for a really long time.
And is there, I mean, I'm hoping that a Democratic administration will come in January and fix things. Has anyone in the Biden campaign reached out to you by any chance?
Well, I'm not going to answer that question exactly yet.
Okay. All right.
Well, that's all I'm going to say right now.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there, and I'll take that as a bit of good news, hopefully, to be coming soon. So I've kept you on a while. Let's talk about the book, The Deficit Myth. It comes out in just about 3 weeks, or a little less than a month. And it tells about modern monetary theory. I guess this is a really good time for this book to come out, huh?
You know, it's funny. I broke my arm a couple of years ago. I fractured my wrist and I had to have surgery and I had a plate and I had all this physical therapy. And it was a long time before I could actually turn my hand from my palm being up to my palm being down, which meant it took a long time before I could type again. With any, you know, real speed. So it delayed the book quite a bit. And now, you know, I said to my husband a couple months ago, thank God I broke my arm. You know, because I think the timing really, really is, it would be difficult to have intentionally timed the release of the book any better, I think. Because on the one hand, you know, governments around the world are increasing spending without increasing taxes. In other words, deficit spending is happening all over the world on a huge scale. And you might think, oh, well, everybody's over the deficit myth because governments are just, you know, using deficits to address the weak economy and the health pandemic and so forth. But clearly, you're already hearing, right, this drumbeat around, oh my God, the deficits have gotten so big and the debt is increasing. And so we're going to have to think about cutting Social Security or Medicare or cutting budgets or, you know, the austerity drumbeat has already started. And that's really what this book is about. This book is designed chapter by chapter to help empower, you know, regular people. This is not aimed at economists. I don't think there are any numbers in the book. There are no models. There's no math. It's a book that, you know, it's meant to be accessible to anyone with a, you know, reading comprehension. It's about the only requirement. But I really want to be able to empower people. So when we start hearing our politicians talk about withdrawing fiscal support prematurely, which is what happened in the last crisis, right? We withdrew fiscal support prematurely because everyone started to panic about deficits and debt. And that held back the recovery that cost us in terms of jobs. It cost people their homes. It cost people their livelihoods. We had a much more anemic and slow recovery than we could have had if we'd remained, you know, vigorous in terms of the use of fiscal policy. So I want this book to try to provide, you know, some kind of a protective layer against this, in a sense, this virus of deficit hysteria that inevitably invades us whenever we see deficits increasing.
Great. And it's so needed right now. And again, this is what's starting to come with this next, the fifth round of stimulus or whatever we want to call it, with Republicans saying, oh, no, we're waiting. And Trump saying, oh, no, I'm not signing anything unless there's a payroll tax cut. Well, a payroll tax cut's not going to help anyone who's not working. Right. I mean, it just to me makes no sense. Then again, I'm the layman here.
Well, you're right. The payroll tax is uniquely beneficial to people who are still on payroll.
Right.
So that 6.2% of your paycheck that gets withheld every single month for Social Security and another 1.45% for Medicare, if that was done away with, it is tantamount to nearly an 8% increase in your take-home pay. That helps you if you're on payroll.
But what does it do to Medicare and Social Security? And it does nothing to help all the people who are not on payroll anymore.
Well, here's the thing. So I have a chapter in my book, chapter 6. And if the Democrats understood, I think, what I argue in chapter 6, the idea of a payroll tax cut wouldn't be so threatening. Because the reason that many Democrats recoil at the idea of a payroll tax cut is precisely what you just said. They think that it undermines the security, the solvency of Social Security. And what I explain in this chapter is that we can protect Social Security. The federal government can go on making every payment that it has promised to future retirees, their beneficiaries, and the disabled into the indefinite future with or without a trust fund that has a balance in it, with or without sufficient payroll tax withholdings. That's the point that I make in that chapter. And as long as Democrats continue to believe that the only way that Social Security survives is with enough payroll tax revenue and by shoring up trust funds and so forth, then I think the program is in real danger. You got to be able to fight back on stronger grounds. And that's what chapter 6 of the book is all about.
I can't wait to read it. The Deficit Myth is out on June 9th. It is available for pre-order at Amazon and all those other places. I'll put a link on the blog at NicoleSandler.com and BradBlog.com, where today's show is posted, and to give you so you can pre-order it. Is there anything I didn't ask you that you think is important to tell people right now as we're all kind of freaking out, looking at these unemployment numbers, hearing, you know, recession, depression, all these frightening terms thrown around? Anything I didn't touch on?
You know, I would say one thing, and that is the urgent need to get aid to state and local governments. That should have been in the third spending bill, the CARES package.
Right.
The Democrats said, no, don't worry. We'll get it next time. We're not done here. Those were the assurances that we were given when it didn't end up in that piece of legislation. And now Republicans are kind of starting to walk away, say, well, we're not in a real hurry to come back and do more. We want to sit back and wait and see how things play out. And we know how things are going to play out because, you know, if you're watching, if you're listening to what governors all over this country and mayors all over this country are telling you, they are telling you that the cuts are going to be absolutely brutal if they are forced into a position because their revenues are collapsing around them.
Right.
And states and municipal governments, unlike the federal government, are absolutely dependent upon revenue in order to operate. They can't run deficits the way the federal government can.
Right.
And so they are begging, they are making it clear in no uncertain terms, if this money is not forthcoming, you are going to see cuts to police, fire, teachers, I mean, social services. It is going to be absolutely horrific. And if you think about, you know, 20 million job losses plus in April, what we're going to face when state and local governments all turn themselves into little Herbert Hoovers and start right with the austerity at the state level, it is just going to make an already catastrophically bad jobs picture and economic picture that much worse.
Wow.
So I think the pressure has to be brought to bear. The Democrats have to stay firm on this, use whatever leverage they might have left. And this time, you know, use it effectively to extract concessions and get this in the next piece of legislation, or we are in real trouble.
Well, that's important information. Thank you for that. Stephanie Kelton, again, the book, The Deficit Myth, hits stores on the 9th of June. Pre-order it now. I can't wait to read it because, I'm your average person who knows how to spend money, and that's about it. So, and these days don't have much to spend. So, Stephanie Kelton, thank you for being a voice of reason, and thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks always, Nicole. Take care of yourself.
You too. She is the real deal. I got to tell you, Stephanie Kelton, I got to meet her a few years ago at Netroots Nation, and she's just as genuine as she comes across here. And every time I've called on her since then, we met, I don't know, 5, 6, 8 years ago, something like that. She's always been there, always been willing to come on and talk and explain things so that I can understand it. And that's saying a lot when it comes to economics. All right, we're done. Thank you for being here. Tomorrow is Thursday. Howie Klein will be here. Lots to talk about then. Thanks for listening, everyone. Take good care of yourself.